as well as further developments from Mr. Montana, and we would have to hear that evidence at some stage. So I just wanted to put it on record, Chair, at the beginning. Thank you. We don't have to take any final decision now, but it is something we would need to consider. Thank you, Chair.
Noted, Honourable Member. After the interaction, we'll have our own in-camera meeting before we adjourn. Some of the issues will be discussed. Any further apology? I've already apologised for the Chair that I'm standing in for.
The apologies I've received from Mr. Singh, who's attending the speaker's event, Mr. Tseli is in another portfolio committee, and Honourable Gordon has got other commitments that prior arrangements. Thank you.
Shall we proceed then? You're welcome, sir. I'll read the document as it's been debriefed, and I'll pop the question then and answer. I think you've been taking the oath. You do have a copy, does have a copy? Okay, no, that's fine. In accordance with Section 16 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act 2004, as a witness to this oversight inquiry, please be informed that by law you are required to answer fully and satisfactorily all the questions lawfully put to you, or to produce any documents that you are required to produce in connection with the subject matter of the inquiry, notwithstanding the fact that the answer or the document could incriminate you or expose you to criminal or civil proceedings or damages. You are, however, protected in that evidence given under oath or affirmation before a House or committee may not be used against you in any court of law, in any court or place outside Parliament, except in criminal proceedings concerning a charge of perjury or a charge relating to the evidence or documents required in these proceedings. Please be aware that in terms of Section 17(2) of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislature Act, a person who willfully furnishes a House or committee with information or makes a statement before it which is false or misleading commits an offence and is liable to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. You are required to take an oath or affirmation that the evidence you are about to give is truthful. You may choose to take the oath or the affirmation. Which do you prefer?
I affirm.
Just read it below the affirmation. Start with page 2. Start with I solemnly. Yes.
I swear that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God.
Are you aware that you've just made an oath, not affirmation? Yes. No, we can do it again. I thought you were... there's no translation. We can... the advocate can assist. Thank you.
Clear now. Thank you very much. Yes. I solemnly affirm that the evidence that I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Thank you very much. Over to you, Advocate.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to yourself, the Honourable Members, your guests, and the committee's witness today. Mr. Koma, for the record, can you please state your full particulars?
Sorry, I just missed that point.
Can you state your full names for the record?
Kulani Alpheus Koma.
You are aware that the committee is looking at the corporate governance at ESCOM, and that you have been asked to appear before it to give testimony about your knowledge and your experience within ESCOM. Can you just explain to the committee what is your academic background and what is your relationship with ESCOM?
I hold a couple of degrees, a BA Communication Science, a postgraduate hard diploma in Journalism and Media Studies, and MBL, it's a Master of Business Leadership. My relationship with ESCOM is that I am general manager in the office of the chairperson. In terms of the substantive value of that is that I am responsible for reputation management as an advisor as well as the spokesperson at the same time.
There has been substantial evidence before the committee which suggests some corporate governance lapses. You have furnished the committee with two documents which we would, in short, engage in. But if you can just share with the committee, when you joined ESCOM, and what was your mandate? What is it that you meant to do at ESCOM?
I joined ESCOM on the 1st of December last year, which would have been 2016. My mandate at the time, which obviously is the founding mandate of my being there still today, was to assist ESCOM get out of the rut, which is a very bad image. At the time, the public protector had just published its report, and it was very clear that the organization was going down a spiral reputationally. So my mandate was to advise the board at material times and strategically to ensure that we are able to deal with the challenges that we're facing at the time and actually get to a level which will have been acceptable for both ESCOM and the people of South Africa.
If I understand you correctly, the objective was for you to restore confidence in both the board and ESCOM.
Yes. It was an admission, the way I actually interpreted it, that the board had realized that the organization was had lost confidence in respect of its ability to perform in the context of South Africans. So it needed to find its feet around it so that the organization could be sustainable yet again.
But my understanding is that at ESCOM there's a corporate affairs team. Was your appointment not in any way a duplication? Or what were the reasons for your appointment over and above ESCOM's corporate affairs?
I sought to understand that at the time when I was approached in November, if I remember correctly, as to why, because I understood that ESCOM had a very big team from a corporate affairs point of view, as I've just mentioned. I was told that they could not meet the expectations of turning around the reputation of the company, so therefore they needed someone who had the requisite experience.
Before you joined ESCOM, can you just take the committee through whether this position had been advertised or you'd been headhunted, and if so, by whom? And secondly, just explain to the committee if there was any document you had to prepare for the committee, for the board, prior to your appointment.
I was headhunted by a board member, Vernette Klein. She was later joined by Zethembe Khoza. Initial conversations were essentially quite broad, later on narrowed to the specifics in terms of what they actually wanted, what they had in mind, in terms of what they wanted this position to accomplish. I then prepared a presentation which they had requested, and at a board meeting I presented a strategy. And the main problem at the time, or so the problem statement, if you want to put it that way, was the stage of capture report by the public protector. That was the main issue at the time. On the basis of that, I prepared a presentation which was then taken through the board, and the result of the entire conversation then is that I'm sitting here today and I work for Eskom.
You assumed duties on the 1st of December 2016, is that correct?
Yes.
You, in your statement, in paragraph 3.5, you discuss the minister's appointment of Mr. Koko as acting group chief executive. Can you just take the committee through your testimony in that regard?
It will have been just a few weeks before I started, and I remember the shock I had. I nearly actually considered, went back on my decision to join Eskom, because I didn't actually understand what it all meant, that there was a tacit admission that reputationally, the organization was taking a huge knock, and suddenly there's a decision that as someone who's quite compromised, as we all know, as Mr. Koko, was actually appointed by the minister. And this was a shock for me. I remember that distinctly. In fact, I received quite a few calls, people asking, am I still joining these guys, in spite of what just the minister did? Essentially, these are my problems. Koko, quite roundly flagged in the media as someone who's totally without any ethics. That was the media part. And then there was an interview later on with Carte Blanche where he totally lied in front of the camera. So a question was asked, and they decided to actually tell, obviously, a different story than what the objective facts were. And the anchor of the show then unveiled the document. He was lost because it was a document and it bore his signature. And that was a national story. I don't think any person who has a reading ability will have actually missed that, whether I were within South Africa or out, you will have actually caught up with it one way or other. In spite of all that, the minister actually appointed Koko. What got me totally messed up about the entire thing was the fact that I had a different understanding of what a shareholder is. It would be someone who's very agile, someone who breathes and lives certain values that are enshrined on them by certain prescripts. When the minister did this, I did not understand really what it could be stemming from. For me, it was actually totally out of place. So we have Koko today. Thank you.
With specific reference to the interview at Carte Blanche, we're going to play you an interview. It is depicted on the screen.
That caused all the trouble. launched on Sunday. Signed by Eskom's Machero Coco, it revealed R500 prepayment for an emergency coal order from Eskom to Tegeta Resources, a company in which the Guptas have the largest stake and Duduzani Zuma has a significant interest.
I don't think anybody was more surprised by that document than I was. That wasn't a smoking gun, that was a red-hot barrel of a rifle.
KD's mining director, Peter Major, was shocked to see Eskom prepay an emerging company only a few days before they took over Optima Mine.
Eskom's job is generating electricity, not funding startups or companies in trouble or companies that have big money.
Our story explains how Optima Mine, that feeds Hendrina Power Station with coal, had run into financial trouble under its previous owners, Glencore. They were losing over $3 million per day, but Eskom refused to alter their contract that expires in 2018. So Glencore put the mine in business rescue, and in December, Tegeta bought the mine. The big question was, how did this Gupta company afford to pay $2.1 billion for the mine, and the document suggested that Eskom had given them a helping hand. After the story, various mining insiders came forward.
If you try to get money out of it, even if it is one rand, you won't get it. For us in the industry, the pain was that you now finally see documentary proof. I don't know how to put it. It's unbelievable.
The allegation from our original sources was that Eskom had engineered a coal shortage at the Arnhem Power Station and then pushed aside their regular BEE coal suppliers in favor of Optimum's new owners, the Guptas. Eskom then gave them a short-term contract to divert the coal they were mining for Hendrina to Arnett at a lucrative price, and then just extended the contract.
Eskom engineered a scenario where they could justify an emergency. They engineered it, and they did that to be able to assist Oakbay to take over Optimum.
Eskom has vigorously denied these allegations. But for Eskom, the problem wasn't just that R500 million upfront payment, but that Mr. Coco seemed to have forgotten that he signed this off to the Guptas to get to resources.
Why did Eskom prepay Optimum R500 million for coal?
We haven't.
You haven't?
We haven't.
Prepayment, is that something that's common?
We do it, yes. We do it in communities. There must be a business case. And if there's a business case, we do it.
But you didn't pay Optimum any prepayment.
I'm not aware of that.
Okay, just help me out here. This is a document that I have that I want you to please have a look at it. And it's the board tender committee, the approved minutes. According to this, Tegeta has requested that Eskom consider some form of prepayment. So what is this?
All the cost plus mines are prepaid. And that's no surprise for me.
So did you prepay?
I suspect that's the case.
Yeah, but Mr. Coco, you said no.
I suspect that's the case.
Have a look, but when I asked you, you said no. I asked twice.
I'm not aware that it's paid. Okay, but in the event that it's paid, it's not unusual.
No, Mr. Coco, we are not moving on from this as quickly as you would like me to move on.
No, but let's say I made a mistake. Let's say
you made a mistake.
Okay, I made a mistake. Let's do it.
Okay, you see, one of the biggest mysteries has been, how did the Guptas afford to pay the $2.15 billion for Optimum? And now the allegation is, this is how they were able to do it, because this is good as the money in the bank.
I can't respond to that.
And this prepayment was signed days before the Guptas paid the bank.
I can't. That's your vision. Here's my vision. I have a need for coal. I need to secure the qualities in the same way I do with all other mines. When I prepay Exxaro or Anglo, I don't create stories that say they need to do this and that with their money. When I use the 38 million rand to prepay, that's what it is. I prepay to secure the coal that I need. It's not unusual.
Eskom must have been concerned. As early as last Saturday evening, they began setting up...
You can stop it. Thank you, Chair. So, when you refer to a humiliating appearance on Carte Blanche, where you say Mr. Koko was caught out publicly lying, is that the Carte Blanche interview you're referring to?
Certainly.
This interview that we've seen took place around June of 2016. Do you have any reason to doubt that?
Well, for some reason then I recorded it differently. It was, to my mind, it was before I joined ESCOM.
I'm going to show you a document here, which is a submission that is made to the board tender committee on its meeting of the 11th of April 2016. And I'd like you to help assist the committee understand the signatories of this document.
Yes. So these are senior executives of ESCOM. I'm focusing on the signatories. So Andan Data is our executive at Primary Energy. Edwin Mabelane at the time was the head of procurement. And then Majela Koko was a group executive of generations.
You go to the first page of the document and read the heading and the dates, the date on the document.
Submission to the Board Tender Committee on 11 April 2016.
Can you, for the record, read the submission, the entire submission?
Addendum to the short-term coal supply agreement between various suppliers and ESCOM Pty Limited for the supply of coal to Arnold Power Station. Resolution required. Resolved that approval be and is hereby granted that addenda to the short-term supply agreements between various suppliers and ESCOM be concluded to extend the supply of coal from various sources of Arnold Power Station for up to a further 5 months and all such period as may be requested by the supplier, but no later than 30 November 2016. The Chief Financial Officer is hereby authorized to approve the basis for repayment to secure the fixed coal price for the period of extension. The group executive generation is hereby authorized to take all the necessary steps to give effect to the above, including the signing of any consents or any other documentation necessary or related thereto. Summary of facts, salient facts underneath. The requirements for the supply of contract coal originates from the April 2016 supply chain as presented at the Primary Energy Technical Control Center of 8 April 2016. It was identified that supply to Arnold will be inadequate to meet the band requirements of the power station over the winter months, and that there is an urgent need to for additional coal. This identified requirement is as a result of the need to build up stock days over a short period while the RFP for Arnold is being finalized. This shortfall of supply amounts to approximately 2.1 million tons. At present, this RFP is in the negotiation phase, and it is anticipated that it will take up to a maximum period of five months to conclude the supply contracts. The current short-term portfolio consists of two suppliers, namely Umsimbiti Mining Pty Limited and Tegeta Exploration and Resources Pty Limited. Umsimbiti is contracted to supply Arnold with 540,000 tons and is currently underperforming due to protracted industrial action. The current contract supply will then be depleted in and around June should the industrial action be stemmed and full mining operations resume. The supply indicated a willingness to extend from July 2016 until September 2016 on similar terms and conditions. Tegeta's short-term contracts are for 600,000 tons of coal from Optimum's export stockpile. Supply for these contracts is due to be completed by 15 April 2016. The coal from Optimum's export stock is a higher grade coal that is suitable for Arnold and Grill power stations, and it is difficult to source from elsewhere. These contracts are entered into in terms of the medium-term mandate granted by the Board Tender Committee on 2008. The BTC approved the mandate to negotiate and conclude CSAs on a medium-term basis for the supply and delivery of coal to various Eskom power stations for the period October 2008 to March 2018, and this included the beneficiation of coal by suppliers and their contractors. The benefits of extending these short-term contracts include the coal is being mined and can be delivered without delay. Tegeta has the potential to supply approximately 250 tons per month, and Umsimbiti approximately 180 per month. It will therefore be in the best interest of Eskom to negotiate and conclude extensions to these short-term contracts to alleviate the coal shortage at Arnold due to the closure of Arnold Colliery. Additionally, to alleviate the shortfall coal requirements at Grill due to the underperformance of Grill underground mine. By procuring this coal for Arnold and Grill power station, it will assist towards building stock days as according to the April 2016 supply plan as presented at the primary energy TCC of 8 April 2016. There is currently an estimated 2.14 MT tons shortfall at Arnold power station for financial year 2017 and 280,000 tons shortfall at Creel power station for financial year 2017. Both suppliers have indicated a willingness to extend current contracts, however. Tegeta has requested that Eskom consider some form of prepayment to enable it to meet the procurement requirements from the export component of the mine in lieu of the fact that it subsidizes the direct feed to Andrina power station power, and this will enable it to meet the coal supply demands for the two power stations in the short term. Key assumptions. The submission and decision required set out herein is based on the following key assumptions. The qualities as agreed in the existing STC will be delivered. The terms and conditions of the existing STC shall remain. Eskom is securing its coal supply for two power stations in the short term, pending the conclusion of the procurement process. The principles of prepayment for security of supply has been established by various approvals. Financial implications. To date, the cost of coal in respect of these short-term contracts is as follows. Should I read all the... Okay. Tageta Exploration Resources, tons, current, 500,000. Second addendum, 1.2 billion. Rands, current, 735,715. Second addendum, 586,787. Unit cost, 20.41. Second addendum, 20.41.
Okay, I think you can stop now. Now, this is a submission made by, amongst others, Mr. Marcelo Gogo to the Board Tender Committee on 11th of April, 2016. And the interview that I've just showed you took place in June 2016, hardly 3 months from the meeting of the 11th. You've seen for yourself, Mr. Koko, pleading ignorance about that transaction. What do you make of that?
I think it confirms what we already know, that the relationship between him and the truth does not appear to be quite close.
Let's move on then. But you are a reputational manager, having worked at different organizations, both in the public and private sector space, for both individuals and touristic persons. What did you make of that appointment from a reputational perspective for Eskom?
If you look at how high reputations are achieved by companies and people, you actually arrive at one conclusion. They arise from correct and rational decisions by the bearers of those reputations. If it's an organization, it has to be led by correct people so that then correct decisions are made, which then give rise to a good reputation. It's not about words, it's about lived action. So when the minister, obviously the board, maybe I'm emphasizing the minister because she has a bigger responsibility, when the board obviously make a recommendation of a person with such a terrible past, and the minister endorses that, then you wonder what your role is as a reputation person, because I don't appoint people. Anyone who does reputation management does not appoint anyone. So you rely on people to create a platform for a reputation to thrive. That was a decision to destroy the organization, period.
In paragraph 3.9 of your statement, you make reference to a blacklisting of a certain journalist. Can you share that with the committee?
Yes, thank you. When I joined Eskom, amongst a number of things that confirmed to me that actually reputation management is something that possibly is not very familiar with some of, in fact, quite closer to some of the people who are employed to do the job, I found that the Chrissy Eland, a lot of people who know Chrissy Eland as someone who actually is a very ethical journalist, he wants only the truth. And you may hate him for that if you don't like the truth. So he had been blacklisted at the time when I joined. And I soon discovered that. So I sought to find out why. I was given various reasons that really did not make sense. In fact, whatever reason that could have possibly been made available could not have made sense given the fact that this is a democracy. We may disagree, but we don't blacklist each other. So I then debated, I took this up to our Monday meeting. So we used to have regular Monday meetings for corporate affairs, where the executives attend, all of them, including the CEO. So Majela Koko was CEO then. I took it there. I said, I realized Chris Yellen is no longer part of the people that access our account, Twitter account, as well as you know, all the documents of the organization, you know, to which all journalists are entitled, is just excluded. He said to me, well, we argued about it. At some point he said to me, since we blacklisted that guy, my stress levels are actually down because it gives me a lot of stress. Well, I argued the point, as I've alluded earlier. So I didn't win because it became very heated. And then I decided to walk away and seek a different approach to it. Later on, I went to Dr. Ngubane. I presented the same case I presented in the meeting. And then he said to me, no, no, no. Then if that's how strongly you think this thing, you know, is, then tell them that I'm actually removing him from a blacklist. That's how he was actually, you know, the blacklist was lifted. Maybe I should add there when Mlife then joined, if I were to maybe, you know, fast track it, when Mlife joined after the entire fiasco, this matter was then brought back by corporate affairs yet again, that Yelland had been brought back and now he accesses the stuff that he used not to access while he was being blacklisted. And that was distorting our outlook in terms of our social media. Well, I was very quick to say it's now an instruction from the chairman to unblacklist him. So he remains part of our network.
But who had blacklisted the journalist in question? Who had taken the decision to blacklist him? Do you know?
I understand that to have been, because I did inquire, that was Mulife's decision, which was then carried forward by Koko. So typically we would have instructed corporate affairs to blacklist him, and then obviously later on he moved on and then Koko came in and he was very excited about the decision.
Again, what was the effect from a reputational management perspective of the return of Mr. Mulife as Group CEO at Eskom?
The effect was actually totally devastating for Eskom because it flew against the expectations of the society to have him back in the company. So Eskom, like all other entities, operates within the mandate of the citizens of the nation. So when he came back, it was unthinkable for everyone, it's very clear. The media, you know, went on a serious protest. Commentators as well as political parties actually came into the fray. As we know, cases were opened against his return. So all that aid against the image of the organization and therefore the confidence that we could have possibly built if we did not allow ourselves to go that particular route.
But you're the advisor, the reputational manager. Do you share your views with the board or the chairperson of the board?
Yes, I did. But I must admit that I didn't do it to the level I normally do these things when it comes to really strategic decisions that I think are irrational. I normally write things down because I know a moment will come when I would be asked, what did you do? On this particular one, when it was presented to me as something that could possibly happen, I thought it was not possible. I just thought, of everything that can possibly happen, Mlife will not come back. This is how I ended up not writing it down. I said to myself, the minister is going to stop this. There's just no way that she's going to allow this to happen. So eventually I decided not to write it down. I just spoke about it. I raised the concerns, all the risks that I know reputationally, but I did not put anything down, which is what I regret.
You know, part and parcel of ESCOM, and there's this Denton's report. What is your role and how this report is handled within ESCOM? I understand there are various versions of this report. Maybe you can assist us to understand better.
So, when I joined, obviously there was the state of capture report, and later on there was the Denton's report, which now added another layer to the damage on the reputation. So essentially the main issue there was the non-availability of the state of capture of the Denton's report. So the media was aware that an investigation which culminated in four executives being suspended had been done and concluded, but the report, though it had been promised at the time of the commencement of the investigation, it was not. So it was held within reps. So at that particular point, I think it would have been early this year, the media started, particularly Sekonati Manjanja of the Business Day. He was the catalyst here. He wanted the report, he wanted to know what the contents were, and ESCOM did not want to hear about releasing that report. I had various conversations with individual members of the board, and I had one major conversation with them, where eventually I presented what was a risk profile presented by the non-disclosure of the Denton's report. In that meeting, there was agreement generally that the report be released to the media. But Mr. Arnold Singh was not convinced. I was at pain to try to understand really why he did not see the reason, as I was actually presenting, that perspective, because I wanted to understand if I was missing a particular point, hence he could not take the fact that the report, when everyone else was saying, okay, no, we hear you, let's release it. So a couple of days later, between that meeting, I think it would have been on the 2nd, on the 7th, there was to be a press conference when there would be a release of this particular report, publicly, unfettered, as it was received from Denton's. And then there was a shift. An opinion was suddenly solicited, which opinion then precluded the release of the report, as it was, and we had already committed that to the media. So I think in a statement, in fact, in an invite, We had said we're going to release the report. Suddenly we get an opinion, and the lawyers tell us that we should not, it should be redacted, and it should be released through PIA. Now, from a PR reputation point of view, that is an absolute no. When you make a commitment with the media, even if it's a wrong commitment, you need to take it in the chin, live with it, because it's exactly how you lose image as leaders when you make a commitment and then you turn against it. So that's how it was actually handled. So the reputational impact was maximum there, quite negative.
The opinion that you prepared for the acting chairperson of the board, Mr. Khoza, which subsequently served before the board, can you just take the committee through what prompted the opinion and how the opinion was prepared and how it made its way to a board meeting?
So I provided dates on the document itself. I will just tell a story. For dates, you can always refer back to the document. When Mr. Khoza was appointed, he asked me what could be his priorities so that he could then become a formal chairperson of the board. So it was just an ambition, nothing wrong with it, but he wanted to know how he could then do that through the work that he's supposed to do. I took advantage of that. I then wrote an... In fact, I took an advantage of that. I then engaged him because it is something that had been in my mind for a while. With Dr. Ngubane, I was speaking the same language. When he asked me this question, I saw an opportunity to engage him, possibly win in terms of what I think is the trajectory reputationally. I told him that he needs to make some critical but very unpopular decisions. In any case, that's how you gain reputation and confidence. It's not about, the goods and whatever. You have to make decisions that people don't expect, but that are in keeping with the sustainability of the organization, or whatever cause that we are pushing. So we debated it a little bit, and I told him exactly what I meant. I said, the people who are depleting the reputation and eating the veil of this company every day is Majela Koko, it is Anoj Singh. That's just the beginning. But you need to deal with those very important people because they are value, positive against negative. There's no relationship. They're actually eating this entire asset of the state, faster than we can ever imagine. I gave him the reasons. They had been mentioned on the Dubai trips, on Oberoi hotel and massages and everything else. And they were not responding to those questions. Because typically as an executive, if you are mentioned negative, then it is not true. You assume the highest mountain and actually protest. They did not explain. Because I asked the questions, because the media was asking questions, and I needed to get answers from them. They were not answering. It was clear that they knew they were not innocent. Now, where does it leave the image of ESCOM? In the doldrums. Then we don't have a mechanism to then correct what the media is causing harm, in fact, is harming us all based on their actions. So then I said to him, we need to get rid of them. He said to me, no, but we need a court decision on that. I said, no. There are two things here. Reputationally, you don't necessarily have to wait for court because courts actually take quite long. Yes, reputation, the reputation actually diminishes every day. You don't need a court decision to determine that. So at the very least, as the head of the institution, you need to protect ESCOM, which remains vulnerable until that court decision is made. So then he tacitly agreed, he said, come to my house on Saturday. I think it would, the meeting would have been towards the end of the week, Friday or so. Then he said, come, I have a ceremony at home, come, let's finish this conversation, which is what I did. I drove to KZN and we met there. There, the conversation was not as long. I already had secured a draft from the previous conversation. Then I started writing because I realized that he was actually almost with me. He was 90% into the proposal. So when we met in KZN, I presented that draft, and then we spoke a little bit. It did not even take long. He said to me, no, I'm happy with this. I'll proceed with it. Go and update it and send it back to me. I remember the day would have been a Saturday. I'm sure I've tried to actually get as close as possible to the dates, if not precisely. But then he shocks me. He says, but this is likely to succeed. Then I say, why? It says to me, because Minister Brown is captured. Is that okay? And then he hastens to explain what he means by that. He says Minister Brown reports to the Guptas, and then he tells me about the new board members. It was the 14th, if I'm not mistaken, but I think the document will... I tried to stick to the story and not worry much about the dates. So he says on the 23rd of June, which will have been the AGM, four board members are going to be announced, and those board members have been appointed by the Guptas. Then he uses the Zulu phrase. He says "abantwana besikole," meaning they are very young. Okay, and then he tells me that actually Dr. Ngubane came very close to suspending Matshela Gogo. But he was stopped right in his tracks by Minister Brown. He says on that particular day, Dr. Ngubane had received an anonymous letter, with a list of alleged infractions against Gogo. And then he conjured up a quick board meeting to seek a suspension. And the board members agreed with him, having looked at the list of those infractions. Gogo was called because it was late in the day, so Gogo had departed the office by then. He was called back to wait in his office. Just moments before, and letters and everything had been prepared to suspend him. So Dr. Ngubane had this, and he had shared the collateral with other board members. He says just before Dr. Ngubane was to call Gogo, he snuck out of the room, that is Mr. Khoza himself, to make a call to a G brother. I understood that to mean a Gupta brother. He says, I snuck out, I made a call quickly to a G brother and told them that Gogo was about to be suspended. They in turn made a call to the minister to instruct her to stop the suspension. And Dr. Ngubane confirms this in our conversation, that indeed he was shocked when he suddenly received a call when he was about to call Gogo in so that he's suspended.
Maybe let me let you finish. I'll come back to this point.
Well, my mind is not as innocent, typical of a human being. When he said abantwana besikole, meaning the board members that are to be announced on the 23rd, abantwana besikole, then I look forward to the 23rd so that I can see if abantwana besikole indeed, if they were looking like school kids. Indeed, they look like school kids, and I may be, offending in this regard, but I have to be honest because that's what I sought to do. The three members looked like Abatonabe Squall, I was walking into the mind of the chairman. With the exception of Sati Gounden, who's elderly, but also, quite interestingly, a relic from post office. He was part of the board members that had to make way for an administrator at post office. So Minister Brown had brought us another reject to be part of the board. That was Sati Gounden.
I'm a little bit interested in this meeting where Dr. Ngubane was supposedly going to suspend Mr. Koko. Was it at the time that you'd already been part and parcel of ESCOM, or was it prior to you joining ESCOM?
I was already part of ESCOM.
When would this meeting have taken place, this special meeting called by Dr. Ngubane to suspend Mr. Koko?
It would have been this year. During the, I think, the early parts of this year.
Susan Daniels, would she have been the company secretary at the time of the convening of this meeting?
Yes, and I understand she's the one who prepared the documents to suspend Koko. She will have a personal account of the meeting. I heard all this, but she will have had a personal account because she was company secretary, and she will have prepared all the documentation to suspend Koko.
When you say you later confirm this with Dr. Ngubane, when, at what stage is this?
This was, I think, a month after he left ESCOM.
You then had this discussion with Mr. Khoza about your opinion, where he's giving you a go-ahead. But my understanding is this was still a draft to be finalized. Does the draft then get to be finalized? If so, what happens to this finalized document?
So it was a Sunday then, after meeting him on a Saturday in his house. On Sunday, it will be the early parts of Sunday when I sent him a full document with the changes that he just said updated, did not give me any particular changes to update. Then I sent it back to him. I confirmed in writing via a text message that it had been sent to him. And then I proceeded with my life. This document then, it appears, was then sent to the rest of the board by him or by Susan Daniels, between the two of them. And on the, I think the story in the Sunday, then, in fact, after that, I received a call from the Sunday Times. And when I attended that meeting, they confronted me with my opinion, which I duly confirmed, because indeed it was my opinion. They sought some comment from me, and I wouldn't comment because obviously that would not have been in keeping with the organization. The story then appeared, I think, on the 26th of June. On the 27th, on Monday, it was the very first meeting of this new board, the reconstituted board, as per Minister Brown says. In that meeting, I understand Mr. Khoza and Arnold led the charge in their condemnation of this opinion. It was said that I had overstepped the mark, in how I wrote it. It was prescriptive, and a few other descriptors that they used to really, you know, stamp on it. And then a decision, an instruction was made to Suzanne Daniels to get rid of me.
This opinion, is it the one entitled ESCOM Board Committed Material Fiduciary Duty Infringements, a Roadmap to Recovery, dated 14 June 2017?
Yes.
Can you read this entire document? And I apologize to the honorable members. It is a lengthy document, but I think it is necessary that we have this on record.
Thank you. ESCOM Board Committed Material Fiduciary Duty Infringements, a Roadmap to Recovery, Objective Confidence Building. According to a global leader in PR, Steve Lombardo of Bessin Mastella, the key to creating a positive brand was to reach the public's subconscious mind. He continues, building a brand is telling a story. It is about giving people a sense of who you are, what you believe in, and what you are going to what are you doing to improve their lives. Subjective ESCOM reputation outcomes. However, ESCOM board has, through manifest public perceptions, given South Africans a sense that they are exuding the worst levels of malfeasance and venality. They have convincingly, through pervasive perceptions, told South Africans that they are working hard to destroy the nation's future by capturing ESCOM on behalf of the Gupta family. The current board's trajectory ably attests to the dereliction of duty, of fiduciary duty, at least perceptively. State of mind and attitude declared affront. This report is not about any particular individual, even if mentioned, but about ESCOM and the nation, its economic woes, and upcoming South African generations. Personal affections suspended to make way for a heartless appraisal of issues to arrive at a new future for ESCOM employees and its publics. This is a no-holds-barred document to solidly point out a new direction for ESCOM from the current value-depleting path, infringement of material fiduciary duty. Since October 2016, when the State of Capture report was launched, ESCOM board has been exposed for its poor understanding, willingness, uncaring, tenuous angle, and flagrant disregard of his fiduciary duty. ESCOM is widely seen as having stepped away from his fiduciary duty to fulfill the private interests of the Gupta family to capture this vital national asset. The public domain is littered with various media reports suggesting that the ESCOM board is in an unholy alliance with senior company executives to hand ESCOM to the Gupta family on a silver platter while enriching itself corruptly in the process. The Tegeta contract has played a profound role in destroying ESCOM's brand. ESCOM is perceived to have offered a lousy reason for why it awarded the contract to Tegeta. In spite of numerous explanations, the nation is unconvinced. When Mr. Gogo lied on camera during the carte blanche interview, he sealed the fate of ESCOM perceptively. Why would he lie if he was convinced that the arrangement with Tegeta was above board? It is at this time that ESCOM board should have acted, as this provided them with infallible evidence about the irregularities around Tegeta. The failure to act showed the board to be captured as is according to perceptions. as is according to perceptions, would not act against its own fellow captured traveler. Only ESCOM appears to be comfortable with the Tergeta Award. The nation has roundly rejected it, resulting in major damage to ESCOM as a whole. A poignant example is the recent SCOPA sessions. In this session, it soon became apparent, as it was expected, that ESCOM was trying to flog a dead horse. Our very own PwC report produced grossly negative findings about the award to Tergeta, which states unambiguously that ESCOM bent over backwards, infringing its own processes and policies to make the award. ESCOM's flawed approach persisted in spite of the warning prior to the SCOPA appearance. Critical sources cement ESCOM's reputational fate. Certain documents or sources have been given interminably against ESCOM. These include the state of capture, betrayal of the promise, how South Africa is being stolen, ESCOM's internal investigation reports and Gupta emails. When the state of capture emerged, ESCOM leaped into a defensive gear, lamenting the fact that it had neither findings nor recommendations. While some citizens could extend ESCOM a benefit of doubt, the Gupta leaks have undermined this defensive tactic, as these leaks have overwhelmingly been seen as evidence for the state of capture report. None amongst those mentioned have managed to credibly refute these leaks. They, by and large, appear to be authentic and reliable. I have personally not known a single credible effort to debunk these accusations. Words pale into nothingness against these allegations to make way for the press ombudsman as the main source of relief in this instance. The fact that no credible repudiations have occurred serves to give ascendancy to the allegations. The Mail and Guardian's veracity of Gupta emails, not disputed, ably describes the extent to which the Gupta leaks are fait accompli. To paraphrase the article, quotes the ANC spokesperson. The article quotes the ANC spokesperson was saying for an action against those implicated in the Gupta leaks, in the Gupta emails, owing to the fact that not even a single one amongst the implicated ministers have disputed them. In fact, the story adds that two or three even confirmed the emails. Our own internal reports, such as the Denton's report, cast the board as being too scared to act against certain implicated executives, lest they upset the Gupta family. In essence, the Gupta leaks are increasingly eroding the validity of the remedial action as prescribed by the public protector. In the vacuum, they have stepped in to lead the national discourse. South Africans have accepted this as irrefutable evidence for action to be taken against mentioned individuals. ESCOM board cannot, in all honesty and prudence, wait for the remedial action or any form of a protracted legal process to take action while ESCOM continues to suffer reputational and operational harm. This is the time to change gear by making some of the most unpopular decisions on behalf of ESCOM and the nation. ESCOM wrongly expects South Africans to find accommodation in ESCOM. ESCOM oozes dangerous corporate arrogance, and it is mainly responsible for its atrocious relationship with National Treasury as well as many afflictions it continues to suffer today. A keen ear would automatically pick up disturbing messages which suggest that only Eskom has brains, while the rest of South Africa is intellectually incompetent. We believe our own internal stories to an extent that when quicksand begins to shift right under our very proverbial feet, we are so insulated to even discern it. We need to learn a simple but vital lesson. Eskom exists at the behest of South Africa and therefore should always work hard to evolve within the dictates of the nation. In fact, during the SCOPA sitting, Eskom curiously expected South Africans to hand out kudos for having self-initiated the PwC investigation, the same report which was post facto to the Tegeta deal. Typically, Eskom believed that it had a good story to tell in the PwC report, when the same report uncovered a shameless disregard of the entity's internal policies when it awarded a tender to Tegeta. How do you, when we remote test, believe that we can credibly contradict the National Treasury in their own findings if our own PwC has already found against Eskom? But Eskom did. I think there's a grammar issue there. As a corporate entity which can be sustained from a strong alignment with South Africa, Eskom must refrain with immediate effect from chest beating and realize that it needs South Africa and not the other way around. Eskom borders to forthwith seek credible strategies to align Eskom with the people of South Africa. After all, Eskom exists for the citizens of this country. If this board fails to do this, its name will be permanently soiled and indeed its legacy. The High Court of History will judge it as a board that heartlessly denied South Africans a bright future by capturing Eskom for the Gupta family. Eskom seen as the biggest capture victim. In the State of Capture report, Eskom received most mentions compared to any other state entity. In fact, an unsuspecting mind would be forgiven for assuming that the entire report is about Eskom only. Equally, Eskom is disproportionately mentioned in the Gupta leaks. In the Name and Shame, which is an article, 10 Eskom Transnet Denel directors hired to help Zubda. Eight Eskom directors, past and present, have been mentioned out of a total of 10. Only two directors are associated with different state entities. Eskom board will be well advised to take action now than in the future to restore Eskom to its lost position. Officials attracting this equity and way forward. Mentioned individuals either in the Gupta leaks, betrayal of the promise, how South Africa is being stolen, and other media reports currently include Anoj Singh, Majela Koko, and Brian Liffe. Dr. Ngubane is no longer a factor in the futuristic trajectory due to the fact that he has already left the company. While this analysis does not pass judgment on any of these individuals and even the Gupta family, the resultant impact is too blatant and unavoidably dominant to ignore. The presence of the mentioned individuals in the organization is corrosive to Eskom's equity and South Africa's potential ability to recover from the gloomy global economic outlook, including the downgrade. No reputational turnaround will occur while they are in the employ of Eskom. Their taint is beyond retrievability. They are allegedly associated with a family which has become a decided national outcast. Arguing the merits and demerits of the resultant perceptions has become purely academic and a naked act of burying one's head in the sand at the expense of ESCOM and the nation. Certain things need to be done urgently to restore ESCOM to the sustainable trajectory. The board has to reclaim its fiduciary duty by ensuring with immediate effect that the above-mentioned individuals are removed from ESCOM. Mr. Mulife, whose fate will be decided by the courts, should also be kept far away from ESCOM, irrespective of the outcome of the court outcome. In the event of a court's victory, he should not be allowed to come back to it. He should not be allowed back to ESCOM. A sanction must be applied in this instance, if need be. The suggested decisive action will usher in a new dawn for ESCOM. The board will be seen as cleaning up the perceived or real rot. This will boost the social standing of the board and, importantly, of ESCOM as a brand. ESCOM has to operate within the will of the citizens, and therefore every effort must be made to align it accordingly. In spite of various warnings and advice previously, the board has been impervious and too scared to take action meant to rescue the entity. It stubbornly kept to the path which has caused immeasurable damage to the brand of ESCOM. Why Koko's exoneration amounts to zero exoneration. The findings of the investigation on the alleged conflict of interest relating to the Impulse International should be viewed within the prisms of the public sentiments as opposed to solely focusing on the legal rationale. An exoneration won't close the matter, but it will instead heighten the criticism of ESCOM board and minister. These are the reasons why Mr. Koko is largely seen as corrupt and exempt from censure due to the alleged protection being afforded by the board, which is itself allegedly captured. Nothing makes the same point as an excerpt from a Business Day article which reads as thus. The ESCOM board itself has been implicated in covering up alleged corruption that involved Koko senior managers and board members when law firm Dentons probed the utilities near collapse 2 years ago. Furthermore, not suspending him upon the commencement of the investigation was scoffed at by the media. To them, this was another sign of insulating for him. I think I'm editing as I go along. To the media and other opinion makers, Mr. Koko has already convicted himself regarding the Impulse International matters, and therefore they expect the report to find him guilty. Anything less than that is an insult to the wisdom of the citizens. Tightly, this scandal shouldn't be the end of Koko. The Financial Mail's editorial states, as a matter of fact, that he contradicted himself, and quote marks are used to cement the credibility of the alleged contradictions. So these are the contradictions. It's an excerpt from the article. It all began with Koko denying any knowledge of his stepdaughter's business dealings and what she does for a living, even though they live in the same house. When he denied knowing the CEO of Impulse International, Prakasin Patel, then he denied knowing the CEO, Prakasin Patel. Except it turned out that not only did he know Patra, but he also spoke to him on his cell phone no less than 52 times in an 8-month period. during which Impulse was raking in the contracts from Eskom. Once trapped, Koko said, when he found out about his daughter's involvement, he immediately instructed her to resign from Impulse. Pasa initially said, "I don't know Koko. I only met him at industry conferences." Once caught out, he said, that's Pasa, "Koko and I have a business relationship, which is between Eskom and Impulse International, which dates back to 2015. Initially, Koko's stepdaughter said that she had not benefited from any payment from Impulse. Only now it turns out that actually Impulse paid 16 million to Ukwakiwa Investment, a company of which she is the sole director. Furthermore, some media reports have already cast doubt on the independence of Cliff Decker of Mayor due to the firm's close relationship with Eskom. They claim possible conflict of interest due to the fact that this firm is also representing Mr. Koko in his matter with DA's Ms. Mazone. An exoneration will be seen in the above-mentioned light and nothing else. The media won't accept his exoneration because they believe that he has already lied during the investigation itself, as stated above, and that Cliff Decker is a biased firm chosen to deliver a sham report aimed at exonerating Koko. What complicates matters is the on-camera lie he committed. In the carte blanche interview, Mr. Koko was shown to have lied about whether he had signed a deal with a company owned by the Gupta family. This was an indelible blot on his image. It cannot be erased, as it is immortalized in the files and will be pulled up and used against him at all material times to show up the board and the minister. The recent episode is when the former chairman was confronted with this interview during his recent WEF participation in Durban. Lying on camera is a cardinal sin for an executive, and recent memory doesn't rival this particular incident. It is for this reason that I opine that it will be profoundly naive, dangerous, and irresponsible, even remotely, to imagine the resolution of this matter through legal means, i.e., a favorable investigation. It has long escalated itself beyond this realm. It is about the social standing of both the board and the minister. Bringing him back in any position is both unthinkable and detrimental to both the board and minister. Adding to this, the entire Gupta leaks aggravates the entire situation. It will be worse so for Eskom. CFO's image potentially value depleting. Being in charge of the company's purse strings, the CFO must possess an unblemished ethical image, perceived or real. This role has an inbuilt confidence building responsibility critical to the audiences such as the investment community. A mere suspicion can easily escalate to real losses for the respective enterprise. This is where Eskom finds itself currently. Its CFO has featured prominently in the Gupta leaks. According to the emails, he started the bidding for the Guptas while he was employed at Transnet and has allegedly migrated with this mandate to Eskom. I haven't personally seen any credible effort by him to refute these allegations. While a lack of credible protest may not mean guilt, the resultant impact from allegations is not up for debate, as they have a decided damaging impact on Eskom. While we may quibble about the fact that he has not been convicted of any wrongdoing, Eskom continues to suffer material damage from their SEPIC perceptions. It is suggested that Matela Koko's fate is announced during the AGM or prior to it, while Arnold Singh's is addressed a few days post the AGM. Conclusion.
No, thanks. I think let us skip the conclusion part. But we do have the entire document except for the conclusion part on the record. Due to time pressures, I just want us to move to 8.2. You seem to be discussing an approach by the board to the minister for Mr. Singh to be furnished board minutes after his suspension. Can you just discuss that with the committee and how that matter was handled?
Is that 8.2.
Minister Brown saw nothing wrong with an outlandish request of the ESCOM implosion deliberate, well-orchestrated and shame-free document.
Yes. So, my puzzle here coming in the fact that this current board actually sent a request to Minister Brown to request for his access into the board minutes and other confidential documents. This is reported in the media as a matter of fact, and I think it was also confirmed. It was not refuted, let's put it that way. So the Sunday Times has the extra letter that was written by the board to Minister asking for Arnold Singh to have access in confidentiality, and this is in spite of the fact that he was already suspended. Now, that is a normal puzzle. It doesn't puzzle me only, it will puzzle anyone who knows anything about governance, that when you are suspended, you should not therefore have access to things. But this board had the temerity to approach the minister, and the minister in turn did not find anything wrong with this because she still kept this board. If we are to look at governance in the serious light that we should, people actually should get dismissed for stuff, for even actually having an idea like that cross their mind that a person who's suspended, who's facing allegations that have emanated from the Gupta leaks, Bauman's report, and other sources, and you had DPSA having ESCOM over a barrel, because they wanted this guy to be out of the company because he was actually pulling the organization down. Yet this board fought very hard to still keep him while he was away on suspension.
You make reference to Minister not taking action after being made to mislead Parliament. That's 8.3. Can you tell the committee what do you mean by that?
There was a question that was asked by first the DA on the McKinsey Trillion matter. It would have been sometime towards the end of last year. And because the question was asked to the minister about the subject matter was ESCOM, we provided a response to the minister in turn, which she then delivered to Parliament. That response was prepared by Arnold Singh. He said, we did not pay a cent to Trillion. Meanwhile, we had actually paid them quite a lot of millions. So then the minister in turn lied because she used that information. She was embarrassed by media reports that actually expressly stated that she had lied. Fast forward. Well, she did not do anything before I proceed. She's minister in this government. And someone causes her to lie. Yet she does not actually find anything wrong with it. except to protest for a moment and move on. Because Minister Brown moved on and pretended as if she had never been lied to. Until she put her head down and hoped that it would never come back, this particular matter. And that no one had lied to her. She put her head down. Until when Oliver Wyman had us over a barrel because we had lied again. The same gentleman had released a statement which misrepresented the findings of Oliver Wyman. Oliver Wyman in turn said, correct this within this timeline. They put us on terms. We corrected that. And then Mr. Minister Brown, guess what? As per the norm, she suddenly emerges from under the table and she protests that she did not know what was happening. Now, I think one has to be actually totally lost not to realize that this is totally unacceptable of a minister who was caused to lie in a question, I think it was in November. She did not see that there was something wrong with this transaction and get people dealt with and actually investigate the matter. At that time, that was early warning enough. Singh did not face any music about that. She knows that that information came from Singh. When the Oliver Wyman thing comes up and the media is chasing her down, she suddenly says, I did not know what was happening. If you go back to the statements, you'll actually be shocked. She just said, I don't know. I did not know. When she knew. So essentially, those are my puzzles about this minister.
Just to wrap up, your opinion dated 14 June, it would appear from your statement that you shared it with the spokesperson of the minister. Is that correct?
Yes.
Have you had anything from the minister regarding this damning opinion of this board?
I must admit that even as I shared it with him, I was being polite. I know he's a happy clapper. He would never say anything that could make the minister unhappy. He would never advise the minister of anything that he knows may not please the minister. It's just claps. He's happy. So I expected him not to do anything about it because it's a critical view. And indeed, it doesn't appear he did anything. I've not received any feedback from him.
Now, I'm not asking you about the spokesperson. I mean, the spokesperson is not a shareholder representative of Eskom board, of Eskom. The minister is. So I want to find out if, according to your knowledge, the minister was furnished with this damning opinion that you presented to the board.
No, nothing has come of it.
You are aware that Messeries Tsidiso Matuna, Dan Marokane, and Ms. Tsulufelo Molefe were suspended for what we know today. Nothing. Zero. And the board of which Mr. Khoza was part of did not want anything to do, at least with Tsidiso Matuna and Dan Marokane. What do you make of that contradiction in behavior by this board, in the manner in which those three executives get to be treated, and the kid's gloves approach that is apparently afforded the likes of Messrs. Koko, Anoj Singh, et al.?
Having looked at some documents, my suspicion started when the board did not want to release the Denton's report. Having looked at certain documents, I think I've come to a conclusion that This was an intrigue. A decision was made to get rid of certain people so that one person who was more effective to the agenda was to be retained. If you think about it, those individuals that were suspended alongside Gogo are actually a direct competition to Mr. Gogo in terms of him ascending that position, which was going to make him effective. I think if you believe something different to that, this is going to possibly be an arbiter. When the mandate or the terms of reference were prepared for Denton, they excluded the individuals who would be found to be culpable to the breaches in governance. So the scope of work deliberately excludes individuals. So Denton looked at processes and systems and deliberately excluded individuals who would be found to be culpable. Now, an individual that we know today in retrospect that would have certainly been found guilty is Gogo amongst his executives. I've got a page here that I was given by Dr. Mugani of this call. A person, a representative of that of dentists, is saying this, I think we can read it somewhere. Let me just check it. Got it, and it's 8.1. This letter was sent to the chairperson of the Audit and Risk Committee at the time, Shahid Suleiman. It comes from a representative of Denton. He says in the letter, I quote, I note that the terms of reference in respect of the investigation do not require that misconduct by any specific individual be investigated. Accordingly, as we have seen from our first draft criminal report, we make no recommendations in relation to any specific individual. Now, if leadership is possible, and then this is actually not part of leadership. Because this is actually, we pay $30 million for this, and we are not writing an outcome, because we are saying, let's just investigate academically. Any individual who is found to be culpable is not going to be touched, because the investigation will sketch them very neatly, so that there is no individual to be found culpable.
There is the Denton report, there is the Bowman report, there's just a plethora of reports prepared at Tesco. One assumes they didn't come cheaply. The Tesco must have paid a lot of money. But have we seen any consequences?
No. No consequences whatsoever. Otherwise, we will not be here.
The last question from me relates to having all that you've said here, and some of which is contained in both your opinion and this statement, having been brought to manage the reputation of ESCOM. As the ESCOM board and the minister, the shareholder, done anything to protect the reputation of ESCOM and to discharge their fiduciary responsibilities toward this company? In the interim, not of a family, not of themselves, in the interest of South Africa.
Thank you. Minister Brown and the board. to lead it at government level, then the rest would actually follow suit. The minister appointed Bobo when Bobo had lied on carte blanche. But also, there were media reports that suggested he was corrupt. But this minister appointed him. She did not need to do any in-depth due diligence. It was very clear, it was all in her face. She has just recently appointed Sean Marie, someone who appointed a friend from church without following processes. She just appointed that guy, SMC or ESCOM, appointed by Minister Lynn Brown. She brought Mulife and Arnold, the same people who are also responsible for the destruction of ESCOM. Minister Brown has not responded to the allegations from the media about the infant that is born by a lover at ESCOM. She has not been able to respond to that. And I don't think anything would discourage her from saying it is not true and actually do so actually credibly if it wasn't true. Minister Brown has actually gone to the end of the world telling us that she's not well. Yes, she's right in the midst of water. Her DG is captured. At least allegedly captured. But if the allegations make an effort to respond to them, otherwise then they should take them as true. DG is captured. Her PA is captured. Obviously, a lover is present at ESCOM. So you have a translated ESCOM, obviously, and then people who are captured, that is water to her. So she's in the midst of water. Yes, she says, I'm not wet. And we're supposed to believe that. So the problem here is the minister. She has not been able to respond to the media. She will either say, I've been lied to, or I did not know, or something to that effect. But the fact of the matter is that if you actually remove the position and deal with the issues here, and remove this respect for office which does not take us anywhere, this minister needs to sit here and account, because this mess would not have been possible if she was a capable woman. She's totally incapable. There's no doubt about that. And this is an argument that can be won by any person who has, only the mouth to be able to emit words out of it. The minister can never be able to explain successfully why she is in the midst of water and she is not wet.
And the board, you just dealt with the minister. What about the board?
Well, the board has done. There was a point when DPSA wanted to pull the plug on us because they wanted to see out of the campus. In their own analysis, they said, you either remove this man or you remove our money. But this current board did everything to keep that away. Even when it got to a point of suspending him, of actually putting him away from the campus, it actually sent him on a special leave, not a full suspension. That is why I was able to meet people, our officials, at Rosebank in Joburg. He has been one unassailable individual, yet his vulnerabilities are known. But the answer to that question is one. He understands the business. He's assertive. The board is lackluster. Those individuals that have been brought on board, that have been brought on board as board members, some of them we can't even Google and find them. They have no better start, zero better start. Yes, they run an institution of the state which sits right at the heart of the economy of the country. But those individuals, they've never met them anywhere. I can bet you, if you ever check their name, you're going to come to one conclusion. Where is Minister Brown? Because it takes
some special skill to find an apparent and actually an unseen individual below the surface, which is what Mrs. Abramovich is going to do. She's going to announce another board now. I expect individuals that are not just under the surface, further below the surface, to be ferreted out and they are made board for this very important institution. That is the kind of responsibility, and I think we are too polite because in this country the office is more important than substance sometimes. Mr. Bob Brown has not been asked questions that actually reveal her life. She lied, and she lied all the time, and she thinks we can't see these things. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. No further questions.
Thank you. Anshar, can you take a little bit of a break to allow our witness to stretch? You mean 2 minutes? Yeah, 2 minutes should be fine. Thank you.
2 minutes.